This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Alex. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you doing?
Okay, I'm bemoaning the lack of sun, I'm afraid. I'd like to get out there in the garden.
I think it's all going to start, though, isn't it? Isn't it about to be the Costa del Sol?
Oh, is it? Well, that's great. I'm looking forward to that. I will get out in the garden and think jealously of all the tips you got from Joe Swift when you spoke to him.
I've been away for a couple of weeks and I have to say there has been an upspringing in the meadow in my absence, but I think that applies equally to weeds as delicious lupins. So what can you do?
As long as you've got some lupins, that's lovely.
Yeah. Well, we will see. Coming up on this week's show, an ambitious project to give Terry Pratchett fans a whole new listening experience, and a look at South African artist William Kentridge. But first, many of us associate claims of soothsaying with charlatans or self-deluders. After all, who can possibly know what hasn't happened yet? But half a century ago, editors at a British national newspaper were so convinced by the theories of a psychiatrist that they set up a sort of clearinghouse for members of the general public to report their experiences of seeing into the future. Sam Knight's book, The Premonitions Bureau, details this peculiar episode, and we're joined by Joe Moran, who's reviewed it. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, Alex.
Thanks so much for joining us. Tell us first, I hadn't heard of the Premonitions Bureau. Had you? And was it fairly well known at the time?
Well, both really. I hadn't heard of it, but it was reasonably well known at the time. It was the London Evening Standard that invited what John Barker, the psychiatrist who started it, called percipients to write in or phone in to the news desk. And it got quite a bit of coverage at the time. And I did do a little kind of search on digital archives of newspapers from the late 60s. And there was quite a bit of coverage about it, but I hadn't heard of it at all.
You can sort of imagine that if a newspaper starts up that kind of what effectively was sort of a hotline type thing, it would just be absolutely inundated. I suppose it probably was it?
Well, actually, it surprised me how there wasn't a huge number of the first call out. I think it got about 70 odd people wrote in, which doesn't seem like a huge number to me. But you mentioned kind of the sort of idea that people who have these kind of visions might be charlatans or attention seekers. And they didn't seem like that at all in the book, actually. I don't know whether they were, I don't know to what extent the premonitions were accurate, but they didn't seem that kind of person at all. And John Barker, the psychiatrist who started it, he sort of followed up on the initial calls and and looked for sort of corroboration, and he was fairly convinced that a small number of people did have these premonitions.
I suppose if a kind of fairly serious sounding call came out from a fairly serious organisation, and you did have anything that was remotely like that, you might feel that you had to in case you could prevent something. Do you know what I mean? You just might think, oh, well, if I didn't, maybe people would have been saved.
Yeah, well, there were two characters in the book who are the really accurate percipients. One of them is called, which is called Miss Middleton in the book. The book starts with her. She's a piano teacher from Edmonton. And the other one is he's called Alan Hensher. He's a GPO engineer from Dagenham. And they're actually quite disturbed by the visions that they have, particularly as a lot of them turn out to be quite accurate. They predict a whole series of events like the Torrey Canyon oil spill and the assassination of Robert Kennedy, and there's a rail crash at Hither Green that both of them predicted. And they're not, they don't seem kind of, that they don't sort of get any, that they don't get any sort of thrill about having these visions. They actually, they're very disturbed by them. But yeah, that was one of the ideas that John Barker had, that it would be a sort of early warning system. Of course, the problem with that, I suppose, is if you predict something and then by providing that early warning system, you stop it happening, then your premonition is false, because it's you've made it not come true.
Oh yes, that's a time loop problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
But can I just wanted to ask about the particulars of those premonitions, in terms of like of Hither Green, or I suppose the assassination of Robert Kennedy, you might have been able to say was in the air, I suppose. But those quite specific ones, how specific were the visions or premonitions?
They were fairly specific. I think the Hither Green rail crash was coming. It was going to Charing Cross, the train, and I can't remember which one of them predicted that. But they were sort of eerily quite accurate. They weren't entirely accurate, but they certainly convinced me that it. That there was something in it. Well, one of the things that I really liked about this book was that it didn't really have a take. It didn't really have a theory about whether the premonitions were true or not. And I've seen a couple of reviews at the weekend for this book that found that they actually liked the book, but they found that aspect of it a bit frustrating, that Sam Knight doesn't really kind of come down on one side or the other. But I actually really liked that about the book, that it didn't really have a sort of takeaway or a learning. And it sort of, one of the things that he says is premonitions can't happen, and yet they come true all the time. Mm. That's what you're kind of left with at the end of the book. You're not convinced that they're possible, but they seem to happen anyway. And that's why, I mean, I read this book a couple of weeks ago now, and it's kind of stuck with me really, because of that, I think, because it doesn't sort of, doesn't really come down on one side or the other.
I mean, it all began, as you say in the review, with John Barker, and with the exceptionally well-known and horrendous tragedy at Aberfan. And that's what kind of started him off, wasn't it? It was what sort of galvanised him, I think you say, that people who lived in Aberfan had this kind of unease, and several of them had visions that there was going to be a sort of disaster. They'd had dreams. And then obviously what happened. And I just wonder how did he then, he made contact with those people, I'm assuming.
Well, that was the initial call-out, that the Aberfan disaster was, I think, October 1966. Mm. And obviously it was a kind of huge national story. And given that it had sort of shocked the nation, Barker, who was already interested in what's called precognition, the idea that you might have some kind of extrasensory perception of a future event. So he decided to ask people if they'd had any sort of presentiment of it. And he contacted Peter Fairley, who was the science editor at the Evening Standard, and he agreed to publicise that request. So that's when we got the initial call out to these what he called percipients. I think Abervan is a kind of interesting case to start with, really, because it kind of suggested to me that there might be some kind of middle ground in this kind of theory of premonitions. Because actually, when you see those pictures of sort of massive waste tips above mining villages, they just look incredibly dangerous and precarious. And those waste tips had long worried the locals at Abervan. So you could imagine how, even if you couldn't predict the future, that there might be something that happens in your unconscious mind. Or, you know, we are predictive beings, aren't we, human beings? We rely on we're kind of super forecasters, really. We rely on kind of predicting the future and making a story out of our lives. So you could imagine with something like Abervan that you might have kind of omens and portents just from the evidence around you, just kind of looking at those tips, and just kind of that would all, to me, that would already make you uneasy.
Yes, that's absolutely struck me that actually was a sort of rational explanation, that if you were living somewhere that seemed precarious and dangerous, well, not only might you, as you say, you know, consciously worry about it, but it would not be beyond the realms of imagination to think you might dream about something. I mean, we often dream about disastrous things happening, and often they do have a kind of realism, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was left with at the end of the book. I couldn't quite get my head around the new physics. There's quite a lot about the new physics in the book about quantum mechanics and the fact that time is not necessarily linear, that the linearity of time is negotiable. And I couldn't quite get my head around that. And I don't think most of us can, because it doesn't sort of make sense in terms of our own, the sort of direction of our own lives and our deaths. But I was left with the sense that, you know, maybe human beings are wiser than we know, that we might be able to pick up kind of symptoms or portents and just in the atmosphere that we couldn't necessarily articulate or necessarily kind of prove or kind of argue logically. But that might actually be what gives us those premonitions.
I was very struck by that idea that you had a psychiatrist, and obviously he might be, exactly as you say, sort of trying to tune in to what was going on in people's minds, and indeed their not entirely conscious minds. And yet you also have this other idea, this new physics, as you say, that's actually saying, well, no, it's not a matter of individual psychiatry and psychology. It's actually the case that this could be, because, of course, you know, our first thought is, well, you can't predict the future because it hasn't happened. But it does actually rely on kind of disrupting time entirely, if you believe that that's not the case, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think what's clever about that, I mean, he's an amazing character, this John Barker, is that he's you're never quite clear what his position is. He's kind of interested in the new physics. He's also interested in this conscious mind. And he's kind of driven by lots of different motives, as is actually Peter Fairley, the science editor at the Standard, who he kind of hooks up with. And they're sort of quite conflicted. You're not really sure whether, well, they're doing it for a whole series of motives. It's partly a genuine sort of spirit of inquiry. Probably a sort of genuine altruism, that they want to kind of warn people of these possible tragic events. But there's also quite a bit of ambition as well. You know, they both kind of quite like the attention. They both quite like being sort of noticed. So, and I think probably quite like a lot of people, they're like a lot of human beings. They're a mix of a whole series of different motives. So, yeah, you don't really ever get a sense in the book what John Barker actually believes, you know, whether he's as convinced as his percipients of the... and actually, Peter Fairley isn't. It seems even less convinced. But they're not. They're not kind of cynical about it either.
The new physics. You mean that's the physics that's coming out at the time about quantum mechanics and things like that, which has kind of blown the classical model open. Is that what you? And so there's thinking. Well, if quantum mechanics is real, then we don't know how the heck things work, which is. I mean, we know more about quantum mechanics now, don't we? But it's still pretty bonkers. So it was them investigating that area, which was brand new at the time.
Well, yeah, well, it wasn't actually that brand new. It was he mentions a book that I hadn't heard of called An Experiment with Time that was published in 1927, I think, by an author called J.W. Dunn. And he was one of these people who had dreams of future tragedies. When he was serving in the Boer War, he dreamed of a volcano that was about to erupt on a French colonial island. And then a few weeks later, he got hold of a newspaper and there was a volcano had erupted on Martinique and killed tens of thousands of people. And his book, An Experiment with Time, was a sort of 30-year history of his own dreams and their sort of intimations of the future. I think actually that book was a bestseller and it was in print for about 30 years. And I think it was Dunn's, they would call them Dunn dreams, dreams that seemed to predict the future. It was Dunn's book that led to people leaving sort of a pencil and a pad by their bed so they could write down their dreams on waking up. But he actually uses in 1927 that new physics, the relativity theory, I suppose, which is, you know, Einstein and quantum mechanics. It's not really something that Barker is as interested in. As a psychiatrist, but it's sort of in the air. And he also mentions in the book J.B. Priestley, a lot of his plays, like An Inspector Calls, kind of play around with the idea of time and sort of disrupting the normal logic of cause and effect. And he was very interested in Dunn's work. So, yeah, it's kind of in the air at the time, I think.
It's also interesting how obviously it's so appealing to people, isn't it? The thought that you might be able to ward off disaster, either on a sort of large scale or just even in your own personal life, by sort of more closely attending to your dreams or tuning into some, well, basically kind of special power that you've got. It must have just been so appealing to people. You'd want to believe that. I'd want to believe it.
And people have believed that. Throughout history, we're quite unusual, I think, in not believing it. If you go back to the ancient Greeks, you know, they believed in fate, they believed in oracles. In the Bible, it's kind of full of prophets like, you know, Isaiah and Jonah and Jeremiah, and so they're very interested in premonitory dreams and prophecies. They believed in them. One of the things that Knight talks about in the book is how scary it is to believe entirely in the randomness of things. There's one tragic part of the Apophan story, which is a little boy who oversleeps on the day of the disaster, and he's kind of his mother sort of gets him up, hurries him off to school, just in time to be killed along with the other pupils. And that's really, and we tend to be haunted by those coincidences because it just feels like our lives hang on a thread, which of course they do. But that's a very scary thing. And we are pattern making animals, I suppose, as human beings, aren't we? We need to fight against entropy. We need to fight against the randomness of the universe by making up stories, compelling stories that seem to give pattern to our lives.
It did. It struck me that it's very similar to coincidence because, of course, you know, most of the time, if you have a dream or whatever, the stuff doesn't happen. And most of the time there aren't coincidences. But when there are, as you say, we've got such a strong impulse to make a story out of it. We go, well, that must be, you know, that's special. That's a special thing for me because this thing happened. But I think like humans aren't very well set up to be able to think about coincidence. And maybe they're not very well set up to think about premonition for precisely that storytelling reason.
Yeah. I mean, I always say this to my students about the sort of the impulse to tell a story that is incredibly addictive, and I compare it to a greyhound chasing, you know, those aniseed covered mechanical hares that they set off before the greyhound race. And the greyhound just kind of, because obviously they like aniseed, so they chase after the hare. And they don't see anything else around them. All they're doing is looking at that aniseed-covered hare. And I sort of think that our addiction to story is a bit like that, that you can, you're just following the narrative line and it becomes incredibly compelling and you just don't notice any of the other possibilities because you're just kind of looking towards the end, towards the end of the story, and you're closing off all these other avenues, the sort of randomness, the sort of chaotic nature of existence, by just focusing on that one sort of linear story. Knight talks about this a bit, just so that the fact that we are, you know, we are pattern making beings, and just how hard it is when you've told that story. And when you've got that story in your head that seems to make sense of your life or something that's happened, how hard it is to then sort of reverse engineer it and kind of imagine that actually that those events had multiple kind of millions of possibilities because they've been closed off by your addiction to just kind of telling the story.
Mm. What is it, do you think, in that sort of, you know, model of behaviour, which I'm sure is right, what is it that makes us addicted to stories, I wonder?
Well, I think it's just, we're meaning-making animals, aren't we, I suppose? We find chaos scary existentially terrifying. So we need to make a sort of an arrow of our lives in some way. It needs to kind of move forward.
I was really interested, sort of sociologically speaking, I guess it's kind of allied, in the fact that this bureau came after this period of mass observation in Britain. And I wondered if there was a kind of cultural enthusiasm for the idea of ordinary people collecting and reporting information and sort of gaining some power, I suppose, in shaping their stories.
Yeah, well, actually, Knights doesn't mention mass observation. It's just something I'm interested in. I've done some mm-hmm. work on. Mass observation was a sort of social research organisation, mainly in the 1930s and 1940s, and they would get just ordinary people to write diaries of their everyday lives, mm-hmm. or they'd interview them in the street, or they'd sort of write down things they'd overheard and people say in streets and factories and pubs. And that was quite new. I think it actually came from newspapers. Think about it, in the 1930s when mass observation started, people just weren't really very interested in what ordinary people thought or had to say. You ever seen those documentaries, those kind of newsreel things where they're sort of ventriloquizing ordinary people and there's a sort of... the clipped tones of the announcer sort of explaining their lives to them. So there was nothing like Vox Pops, which you get all the time now. People kind of ask, you know, there's too much, there's almost too much crowdsourcing now, isn't there? So everybody's encouraged to have their say and give feedback. There wasn't really any of that in the 1930s when mass observation started. So I think a lot of it came from the new sort of mass media, really. Newspapers would allow people to write letters and sort of collate how people felt about things. Opinion polls started in the 1930s. I think it was probably part of that. Obviously, it would take a different form now because you wouldn't need to call into a newspaper or write to a newspaper. You could do it all on social media. I think it was in the air. And I think the other thing that was starting a bit at the time in the 1960s was computers, you know, computer databases, and that was part of their vision, Barker and Fairley, eventually, that there would be some kind of computer database that would collate all this data from these percipients and maybe even offer this sort of warnings about future tragic events.
So I guess the sort of bottom line question is, what happened to it? Why was it discontinued?
If I say that, I'd probably give away the ending.
Don't do that then. We get into real sort of philosophical territory there, don't we? Where people are always kind of saying, if you could know, would you? And I suppose it gets into quite much more sort of troubled waters.
Yeah, well, I suppose in a way it's kind of interesting in terms of plotting that I'm trying to not give away where the ending in a book about premonitions. You could say that it almost doesn't matter doing a spoiler alert, because that's kind of the point of the book, really.
We can all just dream about it tonight and we'll work out what happens.
We will. So I have to ask you, you know, you make the point that you like the fact about the book that Sam Knight didn't come down on any particular side, but did you?
No, not really. Which again I also quite liked. It's like a novel rather than a work of cultural history, really. It doesn't sort of have an overarching argument, and like a novel, there's not a lot of editorializing, and you don't need that, really. You don't feel like you need to know at the end what you think about it. You're just left with it.
It's sort of suggestive rather than prescriptive. Yeah. Well, it sounds fascinating. Thank you very much for coming and telling us all about it.
No problem.
To come on the show, we delve into the world of Terry Pratchett and discuss the South African artist William Kentridge. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Back to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas. Before we tackle another sort of premonitions bureau, one from ancient Greece, we're going to take a minute for a quick birthday celebration. Raise a banana daiquiri, apparently his favourite drink. I'm not sure about that one, actually. I'm sure it was his favourite drink. I'm not sure it was a good idea to drink it. But we're going to raise a banana daiquiri to Terry Pratchett, whose birthday it would have been last week. Alex, what do you think? Do you want to have a banana daiquiri for Terry?
Well, the thing is, I actually love a banana daiquiri.
Do you? I don't think I've ever had one. It sounds quite...
Oh, it's take me back about 30 years and a student bar. And in fact, I think it was probably they thought daiquiri sounded too sophisticated, so I think there might have been a bit more cream in it, and it was called a banana bliss. And having a banana bliss was the absolute height of luxury. Could only really afford to do it on a Friday evening, but it was essentially a boozy drink for teenagers who still liked sugary, creamy. It was a milkshake. That's
with real bananas in, like a milkshake with kind of rum or something.
Yes, something like that.
Well, you see, I mean, now that sounds delicious. That's probably the only vitamin C you got as well over the whole. It's a good reason for having one, though. I've changed my position completely. It sounds brilliant.
Well, I must say, we're actually making this podcast. I don't think the yardarm is even vaguely in sight. And a lunchtime banana daiquiri to me does sound like the end of afternoon working. But perhaps this evening, and perhaps as the spring nights and summer nights lengthen, we may find ourselves on our terraces. May we looking at our lupins, sipping our banana cream based rum drinks.
And thinking about Terry Pratchett.
Yes, exactly. Well, tell us all about this. I mean, this is a huge project, isn't it?
It is, because I think they're re-recording all the Discworld books, and there's a pretty amazing cast list. It's Penguin Random House doing it, and they've got Andy Serkis is reading the standalone Small Gods. Indira Varma is reading all the series of The Witches. And there's other voices popping up. So Peter Serafinovitz is the voice of Death. In fact, we're going to hear him in a minute. And that, of course, that personage, that character is very important throughout the series. And Bill Nighy is the voice of Terry Pratchett himself, in that he reads the kind of introductions and the footnotes. The footnotes are a brilliant part of the books. So his is the first voice you hear, which seems to me to be quite apt, just right, because he's kind of dry and funny and warm, but it's quite sharp. It's not kind of fluffy, if that makes sense. Are you a fan of Terry Pratchett, Alex?
He's not somebody... I would be totally lying if I said I'd read in the manner that his real fans do. But I totally understand why he is so popular, because they are, of course, funny and they're inventive. But they, as you say, they have that kind of sharpness, don't they? And there's a kind of sardonic... but not a kind of skepticism. They're sort of the opposite to cynical, I suppose.
Yeah, they are. And I think some people, and I was definitely included in that, are put off. It's a real don't judge a book by its cover. Because the covers look they're kind of brightly coloured and cartoonish, and they've got gold letters. We were talking about gold letters last week, weren't they? These are
yes.
I'm not sure if they actually have gold letters, but I feel like they do.
And they're sort of childlike, aren't they? They make that's what you're not perhaps primed by those covers to think there's going to be very much a sort of very much gravity inside. And in a sense, of course, there isn't, because that's not the mode. That's not the voice of the books. But they're full of pretty serious themes about power and democracy and all the rest of it, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And multiculturalism, weirdly, though it's not in any way as crude as that, any of it. It's all stories. And you're right, it's funny. It is mostly levity. And also, they do just have really good jokes. But it does It does have really serious stuff in there, I think. I'm a great champion generally of funny books because I think, funny anything actually, because I think people just often think it's a slightly lower art form than, you know, the tragedies.
Is it going to be really too meandering? I don't think so, because we have such brilliant listeners, for me to just go back to last week when, as you say, we were talking about gold embossed letters and we were talking about Jilly Cooper, weren't we? Yeah. And the fact that Riders was a good, and it had a sort of precursor. And for some reason, this really lodged in my brain. And I was thinking of all those books of Jilly Cooper's that I loved to read as a teenager, Imogen and Harriet, all those books that were just a single name or about the romantic trials. And I thought, well, did they have antecedents in things like Clarissa and Emma? Are they sort of modern romantic sexual morality tales? And I suddenly thought, well, this is how people think about doing their PhDs, isn't it? They have a sort of brilliant, if I say so myself, idea like that. And then 10 years later, and they'll be, I think might be a bit late for me to start doing that kind of thing. But I really became intrigued by this thought. Is Imogen by Jilly Cooper the sort of 20th century version of Clarissa?
I don't know Imogen by Jilly Cooper, but what I'd like is for you to read it and then tell us.
Yeah,
or I think you're PhD, going to do that. We'd rather you told us. Because
it'd be much, much more time effective if I just told you on the podcast. I'm going to do that. Yes, let's do that. Anyway, back to Terry Pratchett. This is a huge undertaking, as you say. And I think via your excellent offices, Lucy, we do have a clip, don't we?
We do have a clip. Yeah, we can play a little bit. So this is from a moment early on in Equal Rights, R-I-T-E-S, pun very much intended, which is about the first ever female wizard. And so in this bit, there is a recently deceased male wizard having a chat with Death, who realises he has given his power to a baby girl by mistake.
"I was foolish," said a voice in tones no mortal could hear. "I assumed the magic would know what it was doing."
"Perhaps it does."
"If only I could do something."
"There is no going back. There is no going back,"
said the deep, heavy voice, like the closing of crypt doors. The wisp of nothingness that was Drum Billet thought for a while. "But she's going to have a lot of problems."
"That is what life is all about. So I'm told. I wouldn't know, of course."
"What about reincarnation?" Death hesitated.
"You wouldn't like it," he said. "Take it from me."
"I've heard that some people do it all the time."
"You've got to be trained to it. You've got to start off small and work up. You've no idea how horrible it is to be an ant."
"It's bad."
"You wouldn't believe it. And with your karma, an ant is too much to expect."
The baby had been taken back to its mother, and the smith sat disconsolately watching the rain. Drum Billet scratched the cat behind its ears and thought about his life. It had been a long one. That was one of the advantages of being a wizard, and he'd done a lot of things he hadn't always felt good about. It was about time that...
"I haven't got all day, you know,"
said Death reproachfully. The wizard looked down at the cat and realised for the first time how odd it looked now. The living often don't appreciate how complicated the world looks when you're dead, because while death frees the mind from the straitjacket of three dimensions, it also cuts it away from time, which is only another dimension. So while the cat that rubbed up against his invisible legs was undoubtedly the same cat that he had seen a few minutes before, it was also quite clearly a tiny kitten and a fat, half-blind old moggy and every stage in between, all at once. Since it had started off small, it looked like a white, cat-shaped carrot, a description that will have to do until people invent proper four-dimensional adjectives. Death's skeletal hand tapped Billet gently on the shoulder.
"Come away, my son."
"There's nothing I can do."
"Life is for the living. Anyway, you've given her your staff."
"Yes, there is that."
now for more supernaturalness, if that is the right word, which it definitely isn't, we're returning to the idea of premonitions and precognition in a way, because we're going to talk about a new multidisciplinary work called Sybil by the South African artist William Kentridge. Elizabeth Lowry has reviewed it brilliantly for us, and we're delighted that she can join us today. Elizabeth, hello, and many thanks for talking to us.
Hello, hello.
Can you, first of all, tell us a bit about William Kentridge? He's primarily known as a visual artist, isn't he, do you think?
Yes, he is, absolutely. He began his career in the mid-1970s as a printmaker and graphic artist, and he developed his practice during the apartheid years of the 1980s. So he did begin primarily as a graphic artist, but he's unusual today in being utterly at home, whether he's working in theatre, opera, dance, large civic museums, small galleries, although he's possibly still best known internationally for his linear work.
Yes, I can't think of anyone else really who can operate in all of those fields. He seems to have kind of transcended boundaries rather amazingly.
Yes, absolutely. He's worked, of course, in opera a lot. He's performed, he's staged Monteverdi's Ulysses, Mozart's Magic Flute, Shostakovich, Berg. So his range is very, very wide. And of course, his animations have really put him on the map as well, his cinematic animations. So he's incredibly versatile.
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask a question? Because I just don't know anything about him, to my shame. But that's the point of this podcast. We find out things. The thing that he went in all these different directions, did it sort of happen organically, or did he start in one field and then just start sort of experimenting in other fields and then kind of come up with this sort of hybrid practice?
Yes, I think pretty much. I think the printmaking and the graphic art came first. And then this wonderful response really to, Kentridge was born in Johannesburg, response to the history of Johannesburg as a gold mining city, which triggered a marvelous film series, Drawings for Projection, a series of animated films drawn over 30 years, I would say, in response to South Africa's changing political landscape. So the graphic practice was the way into this animation, the cinematic practice. And then Kentridge also trained himself for some time at the Jacques Lecoq Theatre School in Paris, so he has a background in the stage, in physical theatre as well. And the versatility comes from all of these sources.
It's one of the things that's so impressive about artists who work in that way. It's not just the sort of imagination, but they've got to continually be sort of learning and mastering whole new disciplines.
Yes, absolutely. And the wonderful thing about Sybil is that it pulls together all of these strands. It is multidisciplinary, multi-generic, and it draws on all these aspects of Kentridge's practice. It's also a response quite specifically to the work of another artist, to Alexander Calder, who, of course, is well known for his kinetic mobiles. It was Calder who first injected movement into sculpture, and Kentridge responds to this quite consciously in the piece. He was invited to create Waiting for the Sybil as a response to Calder's own film Work in Progress from 1968, and he draws on Calder's mobiles, his idea of sort of mechanized geometric shapes of movement, of making sculpture dynamic, and he plays with all of these ideas and combines those with his own graphic practice and his work in animation.
So tell us about what you saw, as it were. It's not on anymore, sadly, but it's travelling, isn't it? It's going to Germany and then to California, I think.
Yes, that's right. It was on here only for 3 nights in late April before it goes on to the Ruhrfest Spiele in Germany and then to Berkeley, California. So the evening was divided into two parts. It's a double bill. The first part was a short, about 20-minute piece, The Moment Has Gone, which is quite familiar to people who know Kentridge. And it's a very good way into Kentridge for those who don't. It's one of his signature short films. It brings together his layered ghostly sketches, and it brings them to life. In this piece, Kentridge films himself while making City Deep, which was an animation inspired by Johannesburg's mining history. So he appears in the piece as himself, as his own doppelganger, and it's wonderful because he's reflective, he's skeptical, he's self-aware, and he shows us how he creates, how he makes his animations. We see his very typical images, smudged images, charcoal images, in this case of the Zama Zama. These are the illegal miners who work Johannesburg's city mine dumps, and they're performing this very repetitive, deadening labor with pickaxes. And he shows us the devastated Highveld landscape. It's a reflection of endurance and want. And then as we watch, the animation takes us through the sequence, and the pictures, the images that Kentridge is drawing become pictures that are hanging in the Johannesburg Art Gallery, which of course was itself built during the heyday of gold mining in South Africa. So it's this wonderfully sort of animated suggestion of a landscape undergoing change. This idea of movement is there as well. And what makes it absolutely fascinating is that he doesn't just film the process of the drawing or the drawings themselves, but every erasure, every change. So there's this fantastic palimpsest over which he will then map circles, triangles, lozenges, all the geometric shapes that have been suggested by Calder's own work in progress. And at the same time, as we're watching this, there is a wholly new dimension added by the accompanying score for live piano and male chorus. So this is not just visual, it's also auditory. This is a wonderful, wonderful piece. It was composed by Kentridge in collaboration with two fellow South Africans, the composer Kanga Malangu and the pianist Carl Shepherd. And there is a male chorus for four voices singing to the accompaniment of the live piano. And the singing is astonishing. It's plangent, it's guttural, it's unabashedly melodic. And it invokes the Zulu style of isicathamiya, or close harmony a cappella choral singing. And then after 20 minutes, this magnificent sequence is over. And you sit there just thinking, more, you know, I really want more. And then fortunately there is more. Then we get to the second half of the evening, or the second part of the evening, which is Waiting for the Sibyl. And this is a chamber opera. It's about a 42 minute chamber opera, which was made for the Teatro dell'Opera di Roma, and it was premiered there in 2019. And again, the music is by Malangu and Shepherd, and the libretto by Kentridge has been compiled from snatches of poetry from all over the world, which has been translated into isiZulu, isiXhosa, Sesotho, and Setswana. And this opera is based on the Greek myth of the Cumaean Sibyl. This is Waiting for the Sibyl, is the title, which we know this from Virgil, from Virgil's Aeneid, we know this from Greek myth. And Kentridge reminds us in his program note of what the story was. The story, as he recalls, was that you would go to the Sibyl at Cumae, and you could ask her a question. You know, you could ask her, would things go well for you? Would things go badly for you? Would your life be long or short? And she would then write your fate on an oak leaf, and she'd place that leaf at the mouth of her cave so that eventually there'd be a pile of leaves. But then there was a catch. As soon as you went to pick up your oak leaf and to read your fate, a breeze would rise and blow the leaves about, so that you never knew if you were actually getting your fate or someone else's. And this is the central idea, the motif of this opera. This idea of fate, this idea of the unknown, of what might lie around the next corner, of the impossibility of knowing what might come next. And once again, it's very, very cleverly done. It's Kentridge's approach is again oblique. He looks really at the machinery of artistic production itself.
How does he do that? Because that seems to me, that when you said that, that seems to me very much of Jacques Lecoq thing to do.
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, in terms of the physical theatre, they look behind and you can see how it's made and then you make it, so you get both bits, as it were.
Precisely. It's very reminiscent of Jacques Lecoq, and also of, I think, the ballets of Michael Clarke, the Scottish choreographer, who was very productive in the 1980s, late 80s. The entire opera in Kentridge's opera is performed to this jerky choreography, this avant-garde choreography. Some of it's slapstick, some of it, you know, is very physical theatre. It's even humorous. And it's all backed by flickering projections of type and film. Again, selected animations from the first part of the night, but this time they've been monstrously enlarged. There are more of those Calder-inspired geometries. And then there are pages of text from the libretto itself, which are also flashed up on a screen. And it all contributes to the sense of the cast performing what the libretto calls the meaning's absence. So there's this surreal sense of the avant-garde here of meaning which is reached for but perhaps never quite grasped. Again, here there are nine singers, there are dancers, they inhabit a sort of 1950s retro office, and the set is wonderful, the costumes are wonderful too. This office has maddeningly noisy typewriters, and there's a waiting room with infuriating collapsing chairs, which allows the physical comedy to unfold. And the singers and dancers wear disc-shaped, very Calderesque hats. They're sort of cartoon-like distortions of the round caps of officialdom. So we get this picture of this sort of avant-garde picture of a mechanized society with a frantic pace that's really lost its way. And it lives by these absurdly reductive nostrums, which are flashed up for us. You know, for example, resist the third cup of coffee, you know, resist the third martini, discard all envelopes, medicine bottles, last year's socks.
That all sounds quite sensible to me. But... it's all dependent on context, isn't it?
Possibly. So it's humorous. And then there are these moments which are not humorous. There are moments where the prophecies, the Sybil's prophecies, such as they are astringent. They're bracing. They're very ominous. The Sybil herself is memorably danced by Teresa Putti-Mujela. And she stands on a platform. She twists and she shudders on this spotlit stage, and she creates a vast moving shadow across the words of the libretto. And sometimes these are, you know, darkly astringent. For example, you'll be led away at dawn, no place will resist destruction, fresh graves are everywhere. And throughout, the entire piece is supported and it's given a real coherence by that astonishing choral music, which threads through it. It's plaintive, it's gorgeous, it's absolutely terrifying, until you really do feel, as the libretto suggests at one point, that heaven is talking in a foreign tongue.
It just sounds overwhelming. I mean, in a really good way, but the whole evening as you describe it sounds absolutely like you're sort of drenched in sensation and meaning.
It is absolutely overwhelming. That's the only word for it. I think it's quite unusual in the richness of its emotional content. Kentridge is someone who doesn't shy away from emotion. The entire piece is deeply felt. It has elements of abstraction, but they are always used in the service of some human emotion, some human meaning. And this is the paradox, really. There's this wonderful interlude, there's a key interlude between scenes, and this interlude is labelled, it's called Rorschach in the libretto, which gives us these giant inky silhouettes. They're thrown against the curtain, they start to turn, and at first it all looks like more abstract drawing. And then as they turn, we realize we're actually watching a revolution in two senses, because they cohere. So they'll take the shape of a leaf, for example, which then becomes an ampersand. There'll be a tree that becomes a typewriter. So there is this crazy coherence. And you realize, you know, this is actually what art does. This is the artistic sleight of hand of art. It's the magical summoning of order out of disorder. There's a sense of resolution, of things being transformed, of things being resolved. And the libretto warns us, again, sort of tongue in cheek, you know, resist the Greek tragedies. It says, you will for 20 minutes have great happiness. It is not enough, but it is not nothing. And actually, by now you're completely succumbing. You don't want to resist. You know, you think, you know, you know, art may not be enough, but it is not nothing. And then the climax comes. There's this absolutely stunning climax. The lead male vocalist, Conlesila Bongwana, begins this recitative about the inevitability of death, yours and mine. And he's discarding the Sybil's pages, the leaves, as he goes. And of course, there's a pun here on leaf. They're the leaves of the libretto themselves as well. And then at the same time, the female vocalist, the lead female vocalist, Zandile Lachuayo, and she's flanked by that whirling shadow of the Sybil and the pages of the libretto flashed on the screen. And she begins this soaring aria, 4 or 5 minutes of resignation to the chaos and the futility of it all. And it's so sweet. It's so painful. You just hold your breath. You just wish it will never end. So it is overwhelming. And you feel that something has been postponed, as the libretto says, you know, not uncertainty, perhaps. Not the uncertainty of being alive, but perhaps fear through art. And it's magnificent. It's absolutely astonishing.
Yes, it sounds extraordinary. And the thing actually that struck me the most about when you're talking about it and writing about it is that, so it's absolutely full of ideas and text. It's quite text heavy, isn't it? You quote lots of the lines there and it's like the program is text heavy. So it's very intellectual, but actually it completely works artistically and emotionally. That has as much weight, or maybe more. I mean, it works as a sort of emotional event and performance as well.
It does, absolutely. And there's also a fascinating parallel here, I think, and you know, quite deliberately, with, you know, talking of intellectual ideas or texts, with Dante's Divine Comedy at the end. There's a sort of allusion there to the Sibylline story in Dante, where the Sibyl is really compared at the end of the Paradiso in Canto 33, I think it was, to Dante himself. She's a messenger who writes down her communications from a god, just as Dante is trying to convey the greatness of his vision of divinity. And the leaf, of course, is metonymic for the frailty of human language, for its insufficiency to convey the truth of our experience. And Kentridge is aware of this. He invokes this idea. But of course, he has communicated. The piece has communicated emotionally, intellectually, on every level. So it's immensely satisfying.
The single only drawback being that we now have to go to Germany or California. Yes.
I can live with that. I feel California might be nice. I mean, we were talking about wanting some sunshine, Lucy. Could we somehow persuade the TLS to send us? Yeah, just expense our trip to California. It sounds amazing. I mean, the way you describe it, it's so vivid, but also sort of unimaginable too. I mean, it just sounds the most extraordinary experience.
It is. It's well worth the trip to California.
Moving sideways slightly, you've got your own intellectual endeavours coming out this week, haven't you, Elizabeth? You've got your new novel is out with a really fascinating subject. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, of course. It's called The Chosen. It is a fictional, but I hope essentially true impression of the days immediately following the death of Thomas Hardy's first wife, Emma, in November 1912. And of Hardy's writing of Tess of the D'Urbervilles some 20 years earlier. It's also the story of how some of the greatest love poems, I think, written in English, which were Hardy's poems of 1912 to 1913, came to exist. So it is a novel about storytelling as much as anything else, and about grief and about marriage. It features a writing career that's gone well, I suppose, and a marriage that's gone badly. It starts in 1912. For 20 years, Emma and Tom Hardy, they're now in their 70s, have been living in virtual isolation, really, from each other at Max Gate, which is the large house on the outskirts of Dorchester, which she built for her. And they occupy separate rooms. They barely speak to each other. And it's quite tragic because once Emma was intensely involved in his writing, she acted as his copyist and daily support, not least in writing Tess, which was the book that made his name. But their marriage has long been soured by his success and self-absorption. And then quite unexpectedly, one November morning, Emma dies. And in the days that follow, Hardy is still stunned by her loss, by the loss of her. And while he's feeling all sorts of emotions, including grief and shock, he discovers a set of diaries that she had secretly kept about their life together, ominously titled What I Think of My Husband.
Oh gosh. And imagine the morning you find that book.
Oh goodness. I mean, I'd write that in code, I must say. I, you know, I'd find a way to
to keep it secret. Yes, well, this is based on fact. She did keep such diaries. They don't exist. He destroyed them very soon after he'd read them. So I had to resurrect them. I had to recreate them. And I imagine that particular in these diaries, she accuses him of having been her jailer and of having deliberately deprived her of the chance to have children. And of course, he's thrown into utter confusion. He has to start re-evaluating his entire marriage and himself. And the question really is, how will this anguished husband and poet, who's always found writing easier than living, respond? What is his reaction going to be? And we follow him through the next 10, 11 days as he comes to terms with the past and puts it back together and tries to make sense of it. And as he begins again the endeavour, the work of poetry, of addressing his experience through art, which is what we were talking about just a moment ago.
It sounds completely fascinating. It's a sort of... it's one of the sort of great literary relationships. I don't mean great as in successful, but because it's such a strong and sad story, I suppose.
It is a very sad story. It's sad because it was Emma's support of Hardy's ambition to be a writer that made her attractive to him at first. I think when he first met her, they were both aged 30. His writing career hadn't properly begun. He was trying to write books which were not being accepted. And I think that's partly why he chose her, because she was supportive. She had this absolute faith in his abilities. And she also loved literature. She loved reading. She had ambitions of being a writer as well. And of course, once she was Mrs. Hardy, these all came to nothing. And the sad thing is that it seems that in marrying Hardy, that marriage turned her youthful enthusiasm for literature into a lifelong prison. I think she found the reality of the literary life very hard to bear, not just fitting around her husband's relentless work schedule, but having to take second place to the constant pressure of an absorbing vision. And of course, the couple had no children. And in the novel, their childlessness and the possible reason for it, which I won't divulge here, becomes really sort of the agonizing focal point of her unhappiness. And I think she must often have felt that in choosing her, Hardy had simply chosen to take literature to wife after all.
Oh, I must say I've also got a tremendous weakness a fondness, I should say, for novels about novelists. And I've got a little niche on a bookshelf into which this will fit perfectly, alongside things like, you know, Adam Folds, which is not a novelist, his novel about John Clare, and a lot of kind of Colm Toybean's work. You know, I think that's so fascinating when novelists try to get into the heads of other writers.
Yes.
So I'm really looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Yes, it sounds completely fascinating. And in fact, there is also a review of it in the TLS this week, right next to your piece, almost as though we planned the whole thing. All the very best for the novel, Elizabeth, and many thanks for joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Jo Moran and Elizabeth Lowry. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Sophia Franklin. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.